Well, I guess not many of us will associate themselves or ourselves with the word reckless. How many times you use this in your daily conversation? Probably not even once a year, right? The word has been used to describe teenagers. Maybe you heard about that. When they are behind the wheels, they drive recklessly. And when they are given a credit card, they spend recklessly. Or when they are left to party on their own, they would do all kinds of stupid things. And maybe some of us can share your story as well. But actually, scientific research can now explain what we just mentioned. Something is called the prefrontal cortex. I was trying to show you a picture, but I say, forget it. It's too complicated, but it's a part of the brain of a teenager. It's called the prefrontal cortex. It's not fully developed yet during teenager's year. And this part of the brain is responsible for things like planning, anticipating, controlling emotion, understanding other people's emotion as well. And if you don't have a fully functional prefrontal cortex, you tend to be impulsive, insensitive to other people's feelings, and take unnecessary risks. So, some of us, if you are still in teenage years, you can explain now to your parents why you are so difficult to deal with sometimes. Okay, so take my word. But once teenagers become an adult, after 19 or in the 20 or maybe in the 30, he or she is supposed to be outgrow the recklessness and impulsivity. And by the time you get to around, I would say, 30 or late 20s, when you have your family, maybe your kids, and you own a home, or you drive a Beamer, or whatever car, work in a high-tech company, live in an upper-middle-class lifestyle, coming to church every Saturday, the word reckless probably doesn't describe you anymore. Outdated. And that is why, once in a while, when we heard about the news, some of the news will intrigue us. Let's give you some example. When they report that a judge, you know, those in the, from the court, a judge has been convicted of paying prostitute for sex. You heard about that? Or a teacher was fired because of inappropriate relationship with students. Or a politician was arrested for grand theft auto and drive under influence. Or senior bank executive were charged with fraud involving billions of dollars. Some of those people ended up going to jail, losing their jobs, their reputation, their family, their lifestyle. They would literally lose everything. These are not teenagers, right? As you heard, I'm kind of quoting. They are grown-ups. They are well-educated, hard-working, highly respected, and extremely smart individuals. The truth is, someone can be grown-up and reckless. People can be smart, highly educated, well-established, and reckless at the same time. So what if there's something besides biology, something besides that prefrontal cortex? What if there's something else in us, an attitude, a way of thinking, and a habit that subconsciously drive us toward making reckless decision and taking reckless action? Give you an example. It's not real, but let's imagine. Let's just say one day you had lunch at the corporate cafeteria. You got your food. It was early. There weren't a lot of people around. You saw her sitting alone, so you joined her. You were just chit-chatting about a restaurant you like in Yale Town. Nice restaurant. Bragging about all the food experience you had. And then you suddenly, she said to you, hey, we should go sometime. Your heart pounds. Is that a we in us? Assuming, you know, I'm talking a male, you know, and a female in the story, right? Or does she mean going there with the team together, our team together? Almost like a reflex. You took out your smartphone and said, sure, we can book a table. You want to go tonight? She smiled back and said, maybe. Let me check something. I'll get back to you, okay? You head back to your office. Your wife already know that. You have another meeting going on this evening. All you need to know is to just call off that meeting. So you make a few phone calls and send an email to confirm, and you are set. An hour later, she WhatsApp you. Are we still on? Let's go tonight. That's how it got all started. What began as a harmless flirt soon turned into an unstoppable urge and a fatal attraction. You could well be on your way to ruin a career, to ruin a marriage, to ruin the future of your kids. Good reflex, clever scheme, seamless execution, reckless nevertheless. Perhaps this is not as remote as it seems. Perhaps it is not so unthinkable. Perhaps it can happen to any of us. It can happen to a coworker, a friend, a relative. It can happen to you and me. So what is recklessness? Recklessness is the willful negligence of one's identity and calling. Willful negligence of one's identity and calling. And at its core is the thinking that you can keep a small, a very tiny area of darkness to yourself, as long as you have it under control. It doesn't harm anyone. You are performing your duty and it is contained. Then you should be able to get away with it. So in this series, we want to explore the attitude, the way of thinking that subconsciously drive people towards making reckless decisions and taking reckless action. We're going to look at the lives of a few characters from the Old Testament. They are not teenagers anymore. One of them is a judge, actually. One of them is a warrior. Another is a king. They're all strong, courageous, smart, resourceful, but yet they have all lived a life recklessly. And this evening, we are going to look at the reckless story of King David. David, just to give you some hint, David became king when he was around 30 years old, okay? But our reckless story tonight did not start until David reached around 50, or at least late 40s, okay? It was a time when David's enemy was no longer Goliath. I'm sure we all heard about David and Goliath, right? But his enemy is not Goliath anymore, but a different kind of giant, a different kind of challenge. So let's go straight to today's passage, 2 Samuel chapter 11 and 12. So we will touch on those two chapters. And to make the story easier to remember, this reckless story can be described as like a four-act drama. So let's go to Act 1. At the beginning of Act 1, Israel was at war. 2 Samuel chapter 11 said in verse 1, in the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab, which is commander, and his servants with him, and all Israel. And they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Reba. But David remained at Jerusalem. in ancient times, you know, most of the time when they have battle, the king will lead the whole army and then at the front line and then fight the war. But to our surprise, David was not on the battlefield at all, but in Jerusalem. And then chapter 11, verse 2, it happens late one afternoon when David arose from his couch and was walking on the roof of the king's house. Then he saw from the roof a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. Someone caught David's eye. Well, the Bible says it very clearly, a woman and a woman bathing. If David turned his eyes away from this temptation, that afternoon, maybe just an ordinary afternoon in his life. But David did not follow that path. As the sun was setting, the king's eyesight was still staying at her. After the evening, David still couldn't get that woman out of his mind. Even after an hour after that evening, still. Verse 3. So David sent and inquired about the woman. You know, he's a king, right? So he can, you know, trace everything, I'm sure. And one said, is not this Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? Uriah, that sounds familiar, the king said. Oh yes, he is one of our warrior, right? Yeah. And he's under the leadership of General Joab. I remember him. Hey, Joab, his team, his army is not in Jerusalem, right? They're fighting the battle in the front line. So that means that Uriah is not in Jerusalem. So when King David noticed that Bathsheba is married, her husband is one of the elite soldiers of the army. Naturally, all this information should point to only one thing. This is a warning sign. This is inappropriate for David to develop any relationship with that lady, naturally. However, David neglected all these warnings. Verse 4, actually. David sent messengers and took Bathsheba, and Bathsheba came to him and he lay with her. Then she returned to her house. As the story develops, the king summoned Bathsheba into the palace. And instead of meeting the king in the office, Bathsheba was led to the king's bedroom. And while Uriah was fighting for his country, at the front line with his best strength, he would never imagine his wife would be with another man. And this man is the most powerful man in the whole nation of Israel. So this is how the reckless story begins. Let's move to Act 2. In the mind of King David, it seems like everything was under control. After that one-night stand, Bathsheba was sent home, and everything seems to be back to normal. But to his surprise, David received a message a few weeks afterwards, verse 5. And the woman conceived, and she sent and told David, 3 words, I am pregnant. As the reckless story developed, another warning sign came up. However, David neglected again. After much thought, David came up with a plan. Well, David was smart, so he was planning. He tried to cover up this unexpected pregnancy. Verse 6. So David sent words to Joab, you know, the commander. You remember him, right? Send me Uriah, the Hittite. And Joab sent Uriah to David, back to Jerusalem. Verse 7, when Uriah came to him, David asked how Joab was doing, how the army was doing, how the people were doing, how the war was going on. And then David said to Uriah, go down to your house, Uriah's house, and wash your feet. And Uriah went out of the king's house and then followed him. It's a present from the king. Oh, surprise, present. Obviously, the king did not really care about what's happening in the battlefield. This is not his most major concern. What David really, you can imagine, what really want to see is that Uriah went back home and had a good reunion with his wife. And under his plan, David's plan, once Uriah came home and settled with his wife, the problem will be solved. The pregnancy will be covered up and everything will be back to normal. As long as Bathsheba kept that secret, she will be still the beloved wife of Uriah, and David will still be the respected king of Israel. Everything will be back to normal. But things did not turn out as nicely as what David expected. And as a professional and loyal soldier, in verse 9, Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants and did not go down to his house, so he did not go back to meet his wife. Verse 11, Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah dwell in booths, and my lord Joab and the servant of my lord are all, they're all camping in the open field, in the battlefield, right? Shall I, Uriah, then go to my house to eat and drink and to lie with my wife? No way. As you live, my king, and as your soul live, I, Uriah, will not do this." So Uriah is professional, he's loyal, right? So what Uriah had told David was like a third warning for the king. But David did not stop. The reckless story continued. David was willfully neglecting his identity as a husband, as a father, and also as God's chosen ruler. Then a new plan came up in verse 12. David always have different plans. Then David said to Uriah, "Hey, how about you remain here, Uriah, okay? Remain here today, and tomorrow I will send you back to fight." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. Verse 13, and David invited Uriah, and he ate in his presence and drank, so that he make him drunk. Wow, you can imagine, you know, expected what David was planning, right? And in the evening, he went out to lie on his couch with the servant, but Uriah still did not go down to his house. Well, David's plan of covering up Bathsheba's pregnancy seems to be going nowhere. Now, the reckless story had come to our third act now, the third act. No matter how hard David tried, all the different plans did not work out. Then David came up with an, I would say, ultimate plan with only one goal in his mind, one goal, to get rid of Uriah. Verse 14, in the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. In the letter he wrote, "Set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting and then draw back from him that he may be struck down and die." Can you imagine this is the plan? Can you imagine this is the idea from David, the shepherd boy who overcame Goliath? The king God chose to write Psalm 23, right? And proclaim the Lord is a shepherd, but he is actually writing this letter. So eventually, David's plan C, I would call this plan C, finally worked out. The loyal soldier Uriah was gone. Gone forever. And General Joab sent a message back to Jerusalem to update what's happened to the battle and also what happened to Uriah. The messenger said to David, verse 23, "The man gained an advantage over us, but we drove them back to the entrance of the gate. Then the archer shot at your servant from the wall, and some of the king's servants are dead. And your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also, my honor." what was supposed to be a bad news, right? Oh no, someone died in our army, right? But this news become good news to David. In his heart, he would say, oh great, finally, finally, Uriah is gone. Gone for good. And after this news reached David, it also reached Bathsheba. Verse 26, when the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she lamented over her husband. Verse 27, and when the mourning was over, it probably takes a few months, David sent and brought Bathsheba to his house, to the palace, and she became David's wife and bore him a son. Finally, seems like this plan C is working. Uriah is gone. Bathsheba now is David's wife. That unexpected pregnancy was no longer a threat to David. As long as Bathsheba kept that secret, nobody in the universe would know the true story at all. Well, verse 27 did not actually stop there. There's one more part. But the thing that David had done had displeased the Lord. Somebody bigger is watching. Somebody bigger is watching as well. So as we look back at the reckless story, so you see the red letter, right? So, but the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. Good. As we look back at this reckless story, we can kind of see the pattern now, right? One, two, three kind of thing. When David knew Bathsheba was married, he would have stopped, but he did not. When David knew that Bathsheba was pregnant, he should have stopped, but he did not. When Uriah returned to Jerusalem but refused to go home, David should have stopped as well, but he did not. All the repeated warnings along the way were neglected by David. And eventually the king has reached the point of almost no return. And that leads to Act 4. When David thought that the crisis was over and his life was back to normal, the reckless story has a little new twist. God finally intervene. You know that, right? The first act, first three acts seems like God is nowhere. It's only human, there's David's planning, actions, you know. But now God finally intervened. Chapter 12, verse 1. And the Lord sent Nathan, the prophet, to David. And when Nathan, the prophet, met the king, he told David a story about two men. There were two men in a certain city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had very many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing but one little lamb. The lamb grew up with him and with his children, and it was like a daughter to him. Now, there came a traveler to the rich man, and the rich man was unwilling to take one of his own of the many flocks and to prepare a meal for the guests. Instead, the rich man took the poor man's lamb and prepared the lamb for the traveler who visited. After hearing all the story and without knowing what's behind, David was quite upset by the story. His anger was greatly kindled, the Bible said, against the man. And he said to Nathan, "As the Lord lives, the man who has done this deserves to die. And he shall restore the lamb fourfold because he did this thing and because he had no pity." David was angry about the story. And now came the climax of the reckless story. Verse 5. Nathan said to David, "You are the man. You are the man." Then Nathan continued in verse 7, thus say the Lord, the God of Israel, I anointed you as king over Israel, and I deliver you out of the hand of Saul, which is the first king of Israel. And I give you your master house and your master wife into your arms, and give you the house of Israel and of Judah. I gave you a lot. Verse 9, why have you despised the word of the Lord to do what is evil in his sight? You have struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword, and have taken his wife to be your wife, and have killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now, therefore, the sword shall never depart from your house, David, because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah to be your wife. Finally, God intervened. What started as an accidental glimpse of Bathsheba has cost Uriah his life. And to cover up this mistake, David became reckless, neglecting all the warnings, and committed first adultery and then murder. And in front of David, the prophet, David knew that it was impossible to hide. David finally realized his problem. It was not just adultery. It was not just about being murderous. David's problem was about being reckless, negligence of his identity, a willful negligence about his divine calling as king. And finally, David admitted he was wrong. Very wrong. Verse 13. David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. I have sinned against the Lord. And after hearing David's confession, this is how the prophet responded. And Nathan said to David, the Lord also has put away your sin. You shall not die. This is the affirmation. Nevertheless, because by this deed you have utterly scorned the Lord, the child, remember the child, who is born to you shall die. In God, yes, there's forgiveness, but David also needed to bear the consequence. The child who is born to David and Bathsheba shall die. And after Nathan the prophet had left, after this conversation, David captured his feeling, his emotion into writings, which became actually one of the chapters in the Bible, Psalm 51. Let me just read you part of it. This is what David wrote down after all these four acts. Have mercy on me, O God, according to your steadfast love. According to your abundant mercy, blot out my transgression. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. For I know my transgression and my sin is ever before me. Against you, you only, have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight. Hide your face from my sin and blot out all my iniquities. God, create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a right spirit within me. Create in me a new heart, O God, and renew a right spirit within me. As we have witnessed, David has committed multiple sins, especially adultery and murder. He was indeed at the point of no return. But to our surprise, by the grace of God, at the end of this seemingly reckless road, there was a way out. When David's reckless life came to a dead end, he finally stopped. He cried out to the Lord. He asked God for forgiveness and create a clean heart in him. recklessness, as we mentioned, is a willful negligence of one's identity and calling. David had become reckless by neglecting his identity and calling as a king. What about us? Are you living recklessly? Are you keeping a little area of darkness to yourself and thinking that you can keep it under control? As long as you have it under control, as long as it doesn't bother anyone, harm anyone, then you think that you should be able to get away with it. From David's painful experience, we can learn something tonight. God never takes sin lightly. Correct? God never takes sin lightly. But on the other hand, we also learn that God will not reject a truly broken and repentant heart. While on one hand, God does not take sin lightly, God will not reject a truly broken and repentant heart. If being reckless and using sins to cover another sin is a poison, then repentance is a very powerful antidote. We all at some point have lived life recklessly. We all have been indulged in our own deeds, in our own thinking, in our own desires. We all have been ignoring all the warning signs around us. But by God's grace, there is a way out. The Bible said, if we confess our sins, He is faithful and just. He will forgive us our sins, and He will purify us from all unrighteousness. Yes, God will not reject a truly broken and repentant heart. Let me give you a minute of reflection. We have heard a lot, we have learned a lot. Let's have a minute of quiet reflection, and then we'll have a prayer. Pray together. Have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love. According to your great compassion, blot out my transgression. Wash away all my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. Create in me a pure heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Many years ago, God gave David a new beginning, creating a pure heart, renewing a steadfast spirit within him. Yes, God is a God who never takes sin lightly, but at the same time, He's also a God who will not reject a true